Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Austin, Texas-based guitarist and composer Don Cento, whose new album with the Cento Trio, Halfway to Mellowtown, is out June 19th on Second Bridge Records. Joining Cento on the album are drummer Norm Bergeron and bassist Phil Spencer. Recorded over the course of 2 days, the album spotlights the trio's improvisational acumen as well as its deep appreciation for melody and hooks. Cento recently spoke about the making of Halfway to Mellowtown, discovering jazz in his youth, as well as details from his impressive body of work as a producer, and how drummer Matt Johnson came to join Cento Trio. That's Don Cento on Into Music, coming up now. This kind of started with you, like, you were really thinking about composing tunes. You were just kind of revisiting kind of an era and so forth, and then that inspired the compositions?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think the drummer on the record, Norm Bergeron, I've known him since college, so going back to the 1990s. Incredible, incredible drummer. He had been suggesting for a handful of years that we put together a little guitar trio, jazz guitar trio, doing instrumental versions of, you know, the 60s and 70s AM FM hits, you know, which we all love. And so finally he twisted my arm enough, I agreed, and we conscripted our friend Phil Spencer to play bass. And so we started doing gigs, and it was really, really fun. I had one song that I had written in college, a jazz tune, which we incorporated into the set. And that just kind of, I don't remember if there was a specific spark that ignited all this, but I just started writing in earnest and everything started coming out. Not everything, but the stuff that was working really, really well. And I was very satisfied and the band was into it. So I just kept writing. And next thing I know, we had what were initially, you know, 2-hour gig full of covers became primarily original tunes. I think maybe the hamburger restaurant where we were playing would have preferred the covers, but that's neither here nor there. And then the Norm and his wife moved back to Maine in May of 2025. So that's sort of, we knew that was coming. So I booked these recording sessions and I wanted to capture the band and capture that band playing these songs. So we did that in 2 days, and what we have is the result of that.
So that was very much, I would imagine, the sort of speed of it was very much down to the fact that you had played the music and really knew it very well.
Yeah, we had played a number of gigs and we did know it very well. But like every experience that I've had making music, you never quite know what you're going to get. So we would get into the studio, we'd have a conception for a song. And there's one song on the album, the title track, Halfway to Mellowtown, which I had an idea of how I wanted it to be. And we had played it that way on gigs. And for some reason, maybe it was the weather that day, it just was not working at all. It was just, it came through feeling forced, and I don't know, it felt wrong. And our engineer, my good friend, Stuart Sykes, fantastic engineer and ears that I really, really trust. He was unconvinced as well. And he suggested we just try completely differently. Cut the form in half, leave out all the solos, you know, just make a couple of changes, change the style, even slow it down. So we just made radical changes to it. And we did, the first take of that is the take that we kept. And I remember feeling during that take, like, this feels, it felt uncertain, but also correct in sort of a magical way. So I do, that's a very specific memory of magic I have from that session.
Wow. So surprises were in store. Were there any kind of like other things, like, I don't know, maybe a piece that, you know, was sometimes musicians will tell me, you know, oh yeah, we had that song and it was always kind of on the cusp, and then something just happened and it lit up in that moment, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think it was definitely that one was the most radical and gratifying transition during the sessions. You know, a couple of the other tunes, you know, we did, there's one cover on the tune, which we always close our gigs with. And we kind of did it at the end of maybe might've been the last song we did. And we just did one take of that. And that turned out great as well. You know, some of the songs took a little more work. Some of them came together in two takes. It's just, sometimes you never really know. It's, you know, the best laid plans are always fraught with peril, it seems. So it's always an education.
What I love here is that this is a record, I guess, that, you know, emerges from the jazz world, but it has this kind of broader appeal. And I think a lot of that is just down to the fact that melody and hooks.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, that's pretty important to me. You know, I've started out in high school and college playing jazz guitar and kind of drifted away from that and have spent decades doing producing and recording pop music, country music, Americana, all kinds of other things. That's all very song focused, as opposed to jazz, which by and large is improvisation. So I became really obsessed with hooks. I always have been, you know, I grew up loving the Cars and Tom Petty and things like that. So it's all about the hook. And so trying to merge those, trying to look at jazz or look at the jazz trio format through that lens was maybe not the conscious goal, but I think that's what I was doing. One of the songs, when I was writing it, it started out as a vocal tune because I, you know, I write songs with lyrics too. And it started out as that. And when I'm writing those types of songs, it'll just be like most of it will be mumble lyrics, mumble syllables, just to kind of fill in gaps and get the melody down. But I had the title, It Takes What It Takes, and I would sing that. And I did a whole demo kind of singing and playing it. And then I listened to it and I was like, this might work for the trio. And so that is sort of where the pop song influence comes into the jazz trio thing. It's literally a pop song that was sort of not forced, but just given to the trio. And it reads really well, I think, in a jazz trio kind of format.
What is it about the trio format that's so appealing?
Ooh, it's just history. It's really a durable thing. Everybody is exposed. There's really no place to hide in the best possible way. And it forces everybody to be a little more economical, a little more melodic, perhaps, with their playing, or at least in my interpretation of the trio format. Just, you really have to be careful. Is your part working? Is your improvisation working? Are you complimenting the song? Are you complimenting your other players? There's not a lot of places to hide.
You mentioned, you know, starting kind of with jazz in high school. What was it that led you to like that particular music?
It was the just listening to records and reading magazines, which is, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And so that was before the internet, magically. So that's what I would do, is I would get a record or a CD and I would look at the liner notes and figure out who played on it. Let's say I started out with like Van Halen, like everybody my age did. And then that somehow led me to maybe Steve Vai, and you'd read interviews with these guys in magazines and they'd mention, somebody would say, oh, Wes Montgomery. And I would go, what's Wes Montgomery? And so I would go look that up, and that led me to Pat Metheny. And then there's gradually, like, there were those moments when you hear a record where it's something like a light bulb clicks. And there was a Pat Metheny record called Question and Answer that was really just sort of, and I don't remember why I bought it, but I bought it. I came home and went down to the basement where I hung out and put it on. It was just like lightning. You know, I'd never heard anything like that. Sort of the velocity of the playing and the intention. I didn't know what those chords were. I didn't know what the drums were doing. It was amazing to me. It still is amazing to me, but it was just sort of connecting the dots, I think.
I remember, those magazines, and they do like a Guitar for the Practicing Musician would have their listening room. And it was like, oh, who's Joe Pass and why is Joe Satriani talking about him?
Yeah, it's exactly right. I think that was sort of a magical, I'm sure that still exists. I'm sure I hope that people are still discovering new music that way through whatever feeds they're on. But that felt like a very, you really had to work for it in a way. Like I lived in a small town in Missouri, so I had to drive half an hour to get a magazine, or a CD. And it was really a big deal.
Yeah, and then hearing just Joe Pass, that was like, I think I don't know who played it for me. I think it was I don't think I was able to even procure a Joe Pass album, but it was
Yeah.
maybe somebody's dad had one or something.
Was
And
it
I
one of the solo records, like Virtuoso or something like that?
Yeah. And it was just like I just remember I can imagine that my eyes were, cartoonishly bulging out of my head with amazement at what I heard,
It's incredible. I mean, yeah, it's hard to envision, but that's just like I was talking to a friend last night, a great guitar player named Matt Oliver here, and we were talking about playing solo and just how incredibly intense and pressurized that format is. Just getting up there on a solo guitar and Joe Pass doing it so effortlessly and sounding like 15 guitars, it's an amazing thing.
So that's interesting because that was the era of like the Guitar Hero and stuff like that, and jazz I think was not necessarily as much in the mainstream the way maybe that it is now. I don't know.
Maybe not. I mean, I remember it was certainly just going back in history, but like the players that were contemporaries at that time, I worked at a music store, and one of the guys that was there was into like the smooth jazz moment. So there's that label GRP. So I remember he gave me Lee Ritenour tapes, and I would listen to that. And there was the band the Yellow Jackets, I think. So there was that sort of in the 80s, it was, I guess Matheny Group were doing their thing, but it was sort of a, which I still love those records. I think they've aged all right. I'm sure there was a lot of traditional jazz going on, but in the guitar thing, it was definitely like a smooth jazz kind of thing, like what you'd hear on the Weather Channel or something.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like Alex Skolnick from Testament eventually left and went and studied jazz, and then he comes out with his jazz trio albums, and I think that was like a real shift where it was like, oh, you can be part of different spheres,
Yeah, I think once you develop a little facility on the instrument, the gates kind of open up, and if your fingers can move and with confidence and your ears start developing a little more confidence and you can, it can be a very attractive, the jazz vocabulary, the jazz thing is can be pretty attractive and pretty all consuming.
So you found this way to work in all these different idioms and so forth. What does that do like for you as a composer? What instincts maybe does it sharpen or make you aware of?
A lot of it maybe has to do with arrangement. I just have had a great fortune, the great fortune to play in the band of several great writers. So I learn about exposing the melody, making sure the melody is right, making sure it's intentional, getting everything out of the way for the melody. I'm thinking about like doing an arrangement or a production where the vocal is the centerpiece and making sure the vocal isn't covered up, just sort of that. Attention to the intention, if that makes sense. That's been a big lesson for me working with like a songwriter that I work with, Jerry DeSica, great lyricist, great writer, and we've made a number of records together, and that's something that he's very that's a drum that he bangs quite a bit is get everything out of the way of the vocal, make sure the guitar isn't covering up the vocal, not the volume of it, but just the part, the busyness, just kind of building a little world around the vocal or the melody.
He has such a unique perspective as well in his lyrics.
Jerry is a one of a kind. Yeah, he really is.
Yeah. So you really don't want to have anything in the way of them.
No, you don't. No, because there's always going to be a turn of phrase that you don't want to get lost.
So coming back to this record and this trio, this I think also arrives at a time where there is a generation of people who are willing to listen to instrumental music, I think it happens about every 20 years or so where all of a sudden it's okay to like music that doesn't
Yeah.
have words.
Man, you might be right. I definitely see it, scrolling around Instagram. There's no shortage of ripping guitar players on there. And it's interesting to see the jazz world kind of change too, from at least my conception of jazz or what I grew up with. It's now a completely, it's not a completely different thing, but it's a different thing. There's a lot more than I would have imagined there is out there, you know, digging around on the streamers or whatever. And it seems like the improvisation is changed. It's no longer not necessarily always about running through complex harmonic changes. There's still a lot of that, but there's a lot more improvisation. Maybe is a little more linear, a little more rhythmic, maybe a little more textural, which is fascinating to me. And it's taken me a while to understand it, if I even understand it at all. You know, I still have a long way to go to kind of really grok what's happening, but it's wild the way things are changing.
Yeah, I mean, I think about like, I guess who was it in the 90s? Like, do you remember Combustible Edison?
Oh, I know that name, but I couldn't tell you anything about the music.
Yeah, I think they were from Boston, and it was that same thing where it was like this instrumental music, and then there was stuff happening in Chicago, you know, and it was like, oh, this isn't like music for old people or squares.
I think I mean, as long as there's a visceral nature to playing an instrument with other people. You know, I think the computer thing has been great. There's incredible stuff that's made with electronics on laptops in bedrooms, but there's just this magical thing, I think, that will always keep happening. Three or four people are in a room playing really loud or softly or together, you know, and following each other down a path. And I don't think that will ever change. It may, as you say, come in and out of vogue. And who knows what drives that? It usually seems like it's a technology shift that is coupled with a fashion shift. But I think that sort of that vitality and that spark will always be there, as long as we have teenagers.
Yeah. I wonder about, you know, what you think about this, because I feel like there's this disconnect sometimes. Like, you know, like I think about friends of mine, they'll go to their child's jazz concert at the high school, but you tell them like, I'm going to the jazz club down the street, and they're like, I can't do that, you know?
It might be, I mean, jazz is a, it's like, you know, it's kind of, maybe it's a little stuffy like classical music now. It's kind of not really as approachable as it was maybe in the 50s. You know, in the 50s, it was party music. It was, you know, a very social thing from what I've read, you know, going to Birdland or whatever in New York City, three or four shows a night, drinking, hanging out, doing that thing. Now it's sort of a conservatory feeling thing. And so maybe that's a little off-putting to people. And it can be very complex. It can be fast. It can be loud and wild and weird. And I think compared to your kid's jazz band, which is probably a show band doing, you know, Take the A Train, which is a great song, that's certainly a little easier to swallow. But I think it's, I watched a funny, we watched Hitchcock movie the other night, The Man Who Knew Too Much, with Jimmy Stewart, and it came out in 53, I think. And there was one moment in there where two of the characters were talking, and one of the guys says, they're talking about music, and he says, I don't go in for this new bebop, which I thought was hilarious. So I guess it's always had its detractors.
Yeah, but I think too, yeah, as more young people play it and so forth, it becomes you know, a different thing, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, injecting different experiences, you know, just different languages. You know, young jazz players have so much more musical language in their rearview mirror than Charlie Parker may have had in, you know, the 30s or 40s or whenever it was. So they're dealing with hip hop, they're dealing with Charlie Parker, they're dealing with classical, they're dealing with the Smithereens or whatever, you know, and just putting that all of that in their pot and stirring it up. So it just comes out different. I read a quote in a book I just returned to recently, Kenny Werner's book, Effortless Mastery. And like on the preface page or something, it says he's talking about, he lists a bunch of jazz players and he says, what is the thread with all these players? And it goes from like, you know, Art Tatum to John Coltrane. And it's innovation is the thread. These are all innovators. It's not the harmonic language, it's not the swing, it's not texture. It's just innovation, thinking about music in a personal, uniquely personal way and staying true to that. That's the tradition, I think, in jazz, or that's something that resonated with me that I read.
Well, and I think with any music that you have to be careful that it doesn't become sort of like captured in amber, you know, the way that rock music is now, where it's
Yeah.
like, you know, if it came out after 85, we don't have
Yeah. Yeah, I what is rock music these days? I have not been paying attention the past year or so, so I don't really know if are there any other. I read about Geese a lot. I know Jack White's still active. He's rock and roll, but as far as that, I don't know what the rock guitar bands are doing these days.
It's a very small segment, you
Is it
know?
just those two?
Yeah, well, I mean, it might as well be too, because it's like we don't have that concentrated attention that we
Yeah.
would have had in the 80s, where it's like, oh, everybody knows Metallica,
Right.
but now there's 15 Metallicas, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there was, we're living just in a totally different world in terms of like consumption or exposure. We had however many radio stations were in your area in the 80s. You had rock, hard rock, classic rock, then an R&B station. There's probably in the 80s there wasn't a rap or hip hop station yet. Then there was the country station and whatever talk station. And now there's everything you could possibly imagine at your fingertips. So I think it was, and everything was a little more gatekept then by the major labels. So there was a consensus for better or for worse. There was a popular consensus about what was good music. There was still underground music. And I remember being fortunate enough to have people my age that exposed me to like the Pixies that I never would have found on my own, you know, or Skinny Puppy and Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that. That, you know, I was concentrating on Pat Metheny or Eric Johnson or whatever, and here comes somebody with Doolittle. And it was just like, wow, this is truly amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So the underground is above ground now.
True. Yeah. How did you come to have Matt Johnson join the band?
A drummer friend of mine in Los Angeles named Blair Cinta, who I've also known since college, was friends with Matt when Matt lived in LA, and Blair just recommended him for another gig several years ago that I had for another group that was playing at South by Southwest. And so I called Matt, and I knew Matt by reputation, and I had seen him play with St. Vincent and was already a huge fan. So I was intimidated to call him, but I did, and he was super cool and played the gig and showed up to rehearsal, nails, just knew it frontwards and backwards, which is now knowing the guy for several years is no surprise. The guy is an absolute monster and an absolute pro. And so then we played that gig and kind of played a couple other gigs here and there. And then when I learned that Norm was moving, another mutual friend of ours in this little scene texted me out of the blue and said, "Hey, you know who you need to get in the band is Matt Johnson." And that sort of clicked. And I mentioned it to Matt, and he seemed interested and enthusiastic. So here we are. And Matt's been in the band since May of last year. So I guess a little over, what is this, April? Almost a year. Was it
Cool.
last year? Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, he's great. He's a tremendous player.
Yeah.
As is Phil Spencer, our bass player. I gotta give him his flowers. Phil's an amazing player, an amazing writer too. He wrote one of the songs on the record that's a great, great song. It's one of our favorites to play called The Builder. So Phil's the best.
You've been listening to a conversation with Don Cento of Cento Trio. The trio's album, Halfway to Mellotown, is out June 19th. You can learn more about the band at their official website, cento3o.com. Find out more about Don Cento's work outside the band at doncento.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson.